We begin Main Street today with a conversation that gets to the heart of what it means to live a good life. And we're doing that in our segment we call Philosophical Currents. It's our monthly discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's back with us. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And he hosts the radio show, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, that airs right here on Prairie Public. Jack, great to see you again.
I'm always happy to be here.
Jack, this discussion that we're going to have today came out of me visiting with you about Linda Pauling's story that we aired about a month ago here on Main Street. And she's the person who created the Make-A-Wish movement. And she did so after unimaginable tragedy in her life when her young son, Chris, died way too early of leukemia. She then inspired what became a worldwide movement. And so it begs, I think, the question, even after something like that, or even without something like that, what makes life meaningful? And is meaning something we discover, like Linda did, something we create, or is it destiny?
One of the oldest questions that people ask is, what kind of person should I be? And inherent in that is the question, what kind of life should I live? For some people, there's a clear answer to that. They have a religious text that guides them. They have some sort of ethical shining star. But for other people, it's a matter of exploration and discovery. And so philosophers have had a wonderful time just going back and forth, trying to pull threads to see which path is the most fruitful. Is there one answer for everybody? Is there a right and wrong answer? Or is this really just a personal exploration? And whichever answer you come to really depends on where you see yourself at your time of life, what culture you find yourself in, where in history you are. There are so many variables that this question has consumed people for thousands of years.
So in philosophical terms, what does it mean to choose one's purpose? Is that choice real? Are we defined or even limited by circumstances and culture? People can say when they're five, I want to be president. Well, a lot of stuff happens after that. What does it mean to choose?
Well, we've already gone down a deep rabbit hole because there's a foundational question even at the below that, which is whether or not human beings have free will. So let me give you an example. When I was younger, one of the things I wanted to be was a great rock and roll star. And I wanted to be that in part because I'm the son of a musician, but I also was growing up in the United States of America in the 1970s and 80s, and there were rock and roll stars everywhere. But suppose I was an Amish kid. Suppose I grew up without technology in an isolated community. Would I fantasize about being a rock and roll star? Probably not. Both because I didn't see the rock and roll stars, but also because even if I knew they existed, it wouldn't be a legitimate possibility. And so the question of choice is bound both by how much agency we have as individuals and how much we can sort of see our own possibilities, but it's also about the messages that we get and the context that we find ourselves in, because culture defines for us what our options are. I can choose amongst those options, but if the culture tells me, as a woman, I'm never going to get to be a scientist, or as a slave, I'll never get to be a landowner, then the choices that I have are much more severely limited. So there's always this balancing between how free we are amongst the choices that we have and how those choices are described to us by the people around us.
Who decides if our life has purpose? Do I decide that for me? Do you decide that for me? Who decides whether we are leading a purposeful life?
So the way to understand this debate is to sort of compare a classical point of view with what's called existentialism. And I'll go back and forth between talking a little technical and not technical here. But we all know that in the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the religions that come out of Abraham, we are made in God's image. And if we're made in God's image, there's a blueprint for human beings. Philosophers will call it an essence. That God designed a plan for our life. God designed a meaning for the human experience, and our job is to discover it and pursue it. And in this instance, and here's a technical way of saying it, essence precedes existence. The blueprint, the plan, the design was around before we were born, and we just have to meet those expectations. But in the early 20th century, for a lot of different reasons, existentialists came along and said, this is backwards, that it's not that essence precedes existence. It's not that the blueprint came before we were born, but rather existence precedes essence. We're born without a blueprint. We're born without a meaning. Some of the existentialists were atheists, but some were deeply religious. Yet they argued that the meaning that we have, the plan that we have, the goals that we choose, the design and that we have for ourselves, this develops over time. Because there is no blueprint, there is no plan, and we get to decide for ourselves. And this leads also to a whole other interesting conversation about ethical relativism. If there's a God and we know what God wants, then there's a right and wrong. And it's clear and it's obvious, but it also can't be challenged. It can't be undermined. If there is no God, or if we don't know what God's message is, then trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong is a lot harder. It doesn't necessarily mean there's no right or wrong, but it does mean that there's a lot more variation and a lot more uncertainty. And so part of what choosing the meaning in our life means is also choosing what we think is valuable, what we think is good, what we think is right, and what we think is bad, what we think is evil, what we think is should be avoided.
I think all of us have lived our lives in a way such that that decision perhaps changed at some time during our lives. We thought we were going down one path. Circumstances presented themselves, and we question whether we are living the purpose that we want to live, and we change direction, so to speak. That must be normal for human behavior, Jack, from a philosophical perspective.
I became a profoundly different person the moment my daughter was born. There's a story that I tell, which I won't get into, but one of the things that I say is that when I saw her for the first time, I felt Earth shift on its axis, right? My meaning, my purpose, my sense of self changed radically, including just spending the rest of my life terrified, right? Being a parent, you're constantly terrified that bad things are going to happen to your kid. Your perspective changes and your relative importance changes. All of a sudden, your kid is the most important thing in your life. Some people feel that more acutely than others. Some people change more radically than others. It's a different experience. There are certainly moments in our lives where biology, where circumstance, where perspective changes who we are. It happens at puberty. It happens probably at menopause. It happens when we get our first job or something along those lines, right? But then there are also times when we discover things. When we discover truths, when we encounter a great work of art, when we hear ourselves in a song. And those kinds of changes are the response of opening up a part of our identity at, I don't know how to say it, that speaks to the infinite possibilities of what it means to be a human being. And to see the universal in our particular experience, one of the wonders of seeing a great work of art, I've been lucky enough to see the Sistine Chapel a couple times in Rome. And I'm not a particularly religious person, and certainly I'm not of the Christian tradition, so I was not prepared for the depth and power of the experience of seeing the Sistine Chapel and the roof of the Sistine Chapel and how I just lost myself in it. And that's one of the wonders of the creative spirit and the imagination in human beings, that we can communicate with someone else's creativity and someone else's assertion that they exist, which is a fancy philosophy way of saying, you know, they did this thing and they were there. And just that interaction can make us see ourselves and our purpose differently.
Jack, how do philosophers talk about purpose and happiness? I guess I could decide my purpose isn't the thing that would make me the most happy. maybe that's true. I'm not sure. I haven't really thought about it.
The first thing is to distinguish happiness from pleasure. So lots of people think being happy is that moment when they're lying in the sun or getting a massage, or for some people, high on heroin, right? There's lots of different kinds of pleasure. And from Aristotle on, people have really been insistent that we have to distinguish between the two in some important ways. Because let's talk about having a kid, for example. Let's say you are a new mother and your baby is 3 weeks old and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're breastfeeding the baby and you're exhausted. You haven't had any sleep. Your body hasn't recovered from the trauma of birth. Your breasts are sore and tender. You have no idea what's going on. You're confused because you're a new mother. And yet you're sitting there with the baby at your breast, and lots of mothers will describe that as the happiest they've ever been in their entire lives. And if happiness is just pleasure, that makes no sense. Athletes who are training really hard or winning at a race that is taking every ounce of their strength will often describe that as a kind of happiness, but it's not pleasure. And what the idea of a purpose does is it gives meaning in addition to just feeling. It gives us a story that we tell. It gives us a place in the universe. It gives us a way to decide what to do next. And so lots of people, and Aristotle is one of them, but the existentialists are too, will argue that purpose is essential for happiness because fulfilling your purpose is part of the criteria for knowing whether you're happy or not, for knowing that you're doing the right thing. And we may be wrong about our purpose, or we may change what our purpose is. You can't say that a watch is doing a good job unless you know what a watch is for. You can't say that a racehorse is an excellent racehorse unless you know what the racehorse is supposed to do. It's very hard to say that you are an excellent person or even a happy person if you don't know what it means to be a person and what a person is supposed to do.
We're enjoying our monthly conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We call the segment Philosophical Currents. Jack's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, where does passion fit into our purpose?
This is a particularly modern point of view. For much of human history and for many, many cultures, the idea of passion was foreign, if not completely unintelligible. People had a role, people had a job, people fulfilled a function, people were citizens or parents or soldiers or other things. And what they wanted and what they cared about was tertiary at best. But from the 18th century on, once we invented the idea of individuality, which is a whole other conversation, once we started to figure out what it meant to be an individual person, we started to value the self-respect that people develop and the sense of purpose that individuals have and the sense that people have to, and this is abstract, but consent to their own lives. They have to choose for themselves what they do. And passion is one of the ways that in our very, very modern understanding of what it means to be a person, we identify that the person chooses their own life, that the person values what they do. If you are stuck in a cubicle working 40 hours a week for a job that you regard as unimportant, for a boss that you don't like, for a salary that you think is unjustifiably low compared to what the owners make, not only do you lack passion, but you feel like you're being denied something important. You feel like life isn't fair. You feel like you're not giving or getting what you deserve to give or get. Passion is one of those things that allows us to escape that trap. If you can leave that cubicle and spend the weekend hiking in a mountain or practicing the cello or taking care of people you love or insert activity there, and that's what's going to be important to you. That's where your priorities are going to lie. And when you have passion, you can also adjust your other behaviors. If you have a passion to hike a mountain, then you also will have a passion to be fit, to eat a certain kind of food, to spend your money on hiking boots or day packs or things like that. If you have a passion for painting or hockey, then you are going to purchase brushes or hockey sticks. You're going to, again, wake up at a certain time or to sleep at a certain time or have friendships that cultivate those activities. What passion allows you to do is give you the will, to give you the dedication and the discipline to focus on the things that you see are as important and that give you a sense of satisfaction and purpose.
We've talked about isolation several times over the course of our discussions, Jack, and I'm wondering, where does community play into understanding and meaning? And simply, can we find meaning in isolation?
This too is one of the fault lines in the history of philosophy. It's generally regarded that human beings are social animals, that we're pack animals. We need other people. And we need other people not just because other people are important, but because it's hard to see ourselves without seeing ourselves in other people, right? Let's just take a silly example. You know, I'm tall, right? I wouldn't know what tall meant if I didn't have other people around me. If all of my friends were NBA players, I would be short, right? I would have a very different sense of myself. What we consider good, what we consider valuable, what we consider satisfying is very much a part of what we see in our community and also our sense of self-worth. One of the great tragedies is there are lots of people who will go years without being physically touched, without being hugged or have their hand held. Now, there are people in the world who don't want to be touched, and that's fine. But as a general rule, human beings like to hug. Human beings like to snuggle. Human beings like to feel someone else's hands on them or even just be noticed by them, be seen by them, be heard by them. Without this touch, without this connectivity, without this interaction with other people, we become isolated and depressed and stuck in our own heads. I mean, you've had this experience. I'm sure all of our listeners have had this experience where you've spent the day alone and you've been mulling over some idea or some slight or insult or something, and you're just getting angrier and angrier and crazier and crazier. And then something happens and you talk to people and you decide you discover you were completely wrong, or this thing never happened, or you were angry about nothing.
Wasn't a big deal at all.
Or right? It wasn't a big deal at all. Or it was a big deal, but you've just gotten over it, right?
Could be. Mm-hmm.
We get stuck in our heads, and we can get stuck in our heads for 20 minutes. We could get stuck in our heads for 6 hours. We can get stuck in our heads for 5 years. There's a whole culture now of young men who get stuck in their heads. They're called incels. And what they are young men who live on the internet who end up hating women because they resent the fact that they feel ignored and put down by women. And then all of their other friends are online voices or text messages and other incels who feel the same way. And they just get deeper and deeper in their anger and their unhappiness, and they blame other people. We need community, and we need other people, and we need other people for meaning, for love, for affirmation, but also for people who experience other things and fail so we don't have to, right? Learn from our elders, learn from the person who rode the bike and didn't wear a helmet and then was in the hospital for 6 months, right? We are a pack animal. And we're never going to be fully who we are unless we're in a community that regards us as an equal, important, integrated part of that community.
We have so much more distraction and noise in our lives today, I think, than we had maybe 30 years ago. Perhaps I'm wrong about that. Perhaps I just care more or hear more about certain things. But it seems to me, with technology in particular, we have more distraction and noise. And it makes me wonder then, is it harder for us to find meaning when we have many different issues bombarding us that we are worrying about, that we maybe wouldn't have even thought about 30 years ago when all this noise wouldn't have been coming our way?
I am sure that that's the case, although it might be 50 or 60 years ago. But, you know, the World Wide Web started in 1994. So that's 31 years ago. I mentioned in passing a heroin addict earlier and how a heroin addict may confuse the high of heroin as a pleasure or happiness. Well, one of the things that science is discovering and that we are all experiencing is that we are all, in some sense, addicted to our electronics, that social networks, that waiting for likes, that seeing the latest TikTok, it increases our dopamine, it affects our serotonin, it raises our cortisol levels, which cause us to be anxious and our bodies to be inflamed, which then leads to heart disease and high blood pressure and all sorts of other things. We are literally addicted to our electronics. And because we are addicted to our electronics, we are constantly looking at a world which is full of anger, full of hostility, full of, even at the best, something like Instagram, where people are showing off all of the wonderful things that they're doing. Most Instagram viewers don't look at a post of someone hiking on a mountain and think, oh, I'll go hike on a mountain. They think that person has it so much better than me because they get to hike on mountains and I don't get to do that. And their life is perfect and my life is terrible and I'm going to be depressed. And all of that is psychological, but at the heart of it is also neurological. It is legitimately causing changes in our brain structure and our physiology. And it is very, very hard to find peace, to find contentment, to enjoy silence. You know, you remember when we were younger, you were meeting someone somewhere and they were late. What did you do? You sat at the table or you stood in the corner and you stared. You thought, you watched people as they walked by, you noticed the pigeons, you did all these things because our toleration for boredom was really our ability to use our imagination. People don't do that anymore. Well, people look at their phone immediately and people don't know how to be bored anymore. People don't know how to exhale. And there are people who are trying to counter this, talking about meditation and mindfulness and all of these other ideas. And then there are people who will turn off their phones for certain periods of time. But as a culture, as a people, and I think most of the people in the world who have access to phones, it is incredibly hard to find peace and contentment. And that means it's incredibly hard to find a purpose. And if it's incredibly hard to find a purpose, it's really hard to meditate on the meaning of your life and why you're here.
Okay, Jack, let's wrap it up with that. And you are not a psychiatrist, you are a philosopher. But for those people who are maybe unsure about their purpose, what's a good philosophical starting point?
Oh, that's a hard question. Because what I would actually suggest, rather than pick up a philosophy book, is find a piece of creativity you love, whether it's a book, whether it's a piece of music, whether it's a painting, and think about why you love it. And use that experience to ask yourself what you find is important. And then talk to some people about why you think those things are important. And that process of finding beauty and creativity in the world and then finding community will help you figure out what you want to think about next, what you want to learn about next. And then maybe there's some philosophy I can suggest, or then maybe there are some other things. But reading a philosophical treatise about the purpose of life is going to help very few people.
I like your suggestions, Jack. We visit with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein monthly on Prairie Public's Main Street right here. It's called Philosophical Currents, and it's always a great pleasure to visit with you, Jack. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota. Thanks.
This was excellent and challenging. I really enjoyed it. Like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pets.